Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
Welcome back to listeners. Super excited for today's guest. This author wrote a really wonderful piece that I think that we're going to really enjoy talking about. It's a topic that we've covered on the show several times over, and so it's going to be, I'm sure, a really spirited discussion. So please, without further ado, welcome to the show, writer Renee Wedderburn. Renee, how are you?
Hello.
Actually, I'm sorry, Renee Sherez Wedderburn.
I love that.
Renee, welcome to the show. We love your name. But listen, so you wrote this piece that was really, it's a really fun topic, but your title was How the Language We Use Perpetuates Oppressive Systems. And when you say we, you're basically talking to other Black folks, and the Black folk are using language that is kind of mirroring the language the white folk use to oppress us. And you open your piece with a conversation that happens when you're at dinner with your then-boyfriend. Tell us, set the scene for us. Who says something to you? What do they say?
Okay, so I was at dinner with my then-boyfriend, and we were with his aunt. And so it wasn't our first time together, but it was the first time that we actually, you know, went out for dinner. And so we sat down, and we were just, you know, looking around the restaurant. And then next thing you know, like me and the aunt, we make eye contact. And she kind of smiles and leans her head to the side, and she says, Renee, you are so pretty for a dark-skinned girl. And of course, it was not my first time hearing this, but it was the first time that I heard it. And for some reason, it just kind of, like, I think maybe because it was someone that was relatively close to me.
Yeah.
And she said this, and I kind of just, I think I didn't say anything. I was kind of in shock. I didn't expect the boyfriend at the time, to say anything. I just kind of smiled and just moved on to eating.
Yeah. I mean, I could see how that would be awkward, hurtful, and really kind of daunting, especially because you all had a previous relationship. So you go from your story to talk about how colorism manifests within Black communities in particular, and how we need to unlearn these associations that we've internalized when it comes to that of color. And so when you talk about when you grew up, right, and you got older, that you realized that colorism wasn't just something that affects Americans. Talk to us a bit about what colorism means and has meant to you in the United States. And then also, when you traveled, how did colorism show up in your travels?
Yeah, so I grew up in Yonkers, New York. And so my childhood in Yonkers, I grew up around mostly white children. And then I moved to a different city where I was then around mostly Black children. And so that was a huge culture shock, because when I was around the white children, I think maybe I was probably naive, and I was a kid, so I wasn't really paying attention to those kinds of things. So even if they were, you know, saying different things about me, I had no clue. It wasn't until I got around Black children. And then, you know, different words like call me Blackie, or you're so Black, you're so dark, that I realized and I started to learn, like, oh, my skin is like sort of a problem. Like, this is like, you know, there's a problem. And then traveling, I realized, and, you know, as time went on, and 2 years ago, I went traveling in Southeast Asia, and Southeast Asia, skin bleaching and skin lightening creams are everywhere on billboards, ads, everywhere you can imagine, in stores, in every product you can possibly think of, sunblock and everything. And so, they really value white skin. I have a friend who's Vietnamese, and she has no shame in saying, and a lot of people really don't have any shame in saying, like, we like white skin. And that's just because in Southeast Asian countries, the lighter skin you have, it's like more opportunities for jobs. And it tells a story of, you might have a good job and you work inside, maybe like in a government job, as opposed to if you have darker skin, then maybe you work in on the farm or outside, which means that you don't really have a good job. And also it's like tells what class you might be in. If you have darker skin, then you may be poor. And if you have light skin, then you might come from like a rich family or something.
That's just so interesting to me. I mean, I want to say, when it came to your aunt, who's another Black person, oh, not your aunt, but rather your dear boyfriend's aunt, who's another Black person, and she was a light-skinned Black woman. And you said there was like an implication in her statement of, you're so pretty for a dark-skinned girl, that was a deeper underlying statement there. And that statement basically was that you should be honored that her other also light-skinned nephew would want to date you. And oftentimes people give us those kinds of declarations or those kind of congratulations, then they're really like backhanded compliments. They're basically saying, like, you should be honored that...
Yeah, because dark-skinned women aren't beautiful.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it means.
It's just... Exactly.
It's the same thing as you're pretty for a big girl.
Yeah.
Because that means it implies that
mutually exclusive.
Yeah, it makes you associate this idea that somehow brown to dark skinned women are not attractive, and then someone designates you and honors you with this backward ass compliment, right? So in your experiences with travel, colorism operates in associations with status, education, income, so on and so forth. But it seems as if here in the U.S., when black folks are doing it to other black folks, the value in light skin versus dark skin, brown skin, has a lot to do with beauty and ideas of standards of beauty.
Yeah. That's what I was trying to get at when I said, like, I understand it differently from other countries. Like, it's wrapped up in, like, social status.
Yeah.
But over here, it's just wrapped up in, like, what's pretty.
What's pretty and what's seen as attractive.
Looks good. Mm-hmm.
Why is it, Renee, to you, why do you think that, right, we understand that the way white supremacy works and white folk don't have distinctions when it comes to black folk. They see light-skinned black folk, dark-skinned, everybody black to them, right?
Everybody's black.
They don't have these. So why do you think that black folks tend to really obsess over light-skin, dark-skin, wavy hair, straight hair? You know, why do we operate within these distinctions when the outside world doesn't really place any value on it?
That's a really good question. I think there's still a lot of internalized, like, I spoke in the article about my own internalizing colorist ideas and colorist beliefs. And so, like, even in high school, like, I started to really believe, like, these light-skinned girls, that the light-skinned girls really believed, like, they were the shit, and, like, they were the end-all, be-all. And I don't know, maybe a lot of it comes from, you know, the things that we see in the black community. So, like, music videos, for example, like, who are the women in music videos? You know, if you have fam, like, black people are rainbow of shades, right? And so, you know, it doesn't take much if you are in a family environment for, you know, the dark-skinned cousin to see that her light-skinned cousin gets so much praise from fam, like, oh, your hair is so pretty, she gets way more praise for her beauty, and maybe the dark-skinned girl only gets praise maybe for her intellect, but never her beauty. So I think there's just, like, different stories and different things that we see, even though, like, you know, white people, we're all black to them. For some reason, I do believe, like, there's a lot of, like, internal racism, internal... It's hard.
It's like the oppression, the hierarchy of oppression, the oppression Olympics even. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I know that in your piece, you said when you were a little kid, there wasn't a lot of mainstream representation, a diversity of the hues of black folk. Do you feel like that has changed with folks like Lupita, Viola Davis, on and so forth? Or do you feel like Hollywood and mainstream film and black film especially? Because I think that black films have a history of doing this. They always posit the object of affection as some light-skinned woman, and the man is always brown to dark skin, right? So black Hollywood really has particularity when it comes to those kinds of, like, feminizing lightness and masculinizing blackness.
Do you think it's always been that way, though, Doc? Because if we think about, like, when did it become that? Because I think about, like even sitcoms of the early 90s, the leading, just like Boomerang, like the leading ladies in the 90s, the early 90s were brown-skinned women. And it seems like the late 90s, you think, when it became the light-skinned...
Well, I mean, when I think of the movies like, because again, they're not necessarily light skinned, but they're lighter than their male counterpart.
Okay, got you.
So when I think of The Best Man, for instance, all of the women that are cast alongside all of the men or their husbands or boyfriends are all
lighter than them.
Yeah, and the one that's
Love and Basketball.
Love and Basketball. And even in Boomerang, I mean, in the end, he ends up with Halle Berry, not Robin Givens, right? So even though she's browner than Robin is also painted as an evil woman as well. And so like, do you think that Hollywood and mainstream media still has a long way to go when it comes to representing the diversity of hues that we as black women have?
Yeah, we definitely have a long way to go. I think obviously, like, Lupita was someone who really changed the way that I started to see myself. And between her and Michelle Obama, like, I talk about them very highly. And Michelle, I saw her speak for the first time when she was, before Barack was elected, like the very first campaign when I was at school. And just seeing her, she really helped me, like, you know, see myself and start to value myself, my skin color, and, you know, proud of it instead of seeing it as, like, a hindrance in some way. And so, of course, I still think we have a long way to go, but I see, you know, little steps here and there. But definitely, you know, like, the way that Hollywood may, or, you know, even from like the 90s sitcom shows and stuff, like sometimes the darker skinned friend was always the one who was always the loudest, or
the comic
book. Yeah, like when I think of Max, when I think Maxine, of Max from Living Single.
Maxine,
yeah.
Or exactly, even
Martin,
exactly.
Pam or Martin, yeah.
Yeah.
Martin and Gina and, yep.
And Pam, yeah.
Yeah, Pam, exactly. So, yeah, so I think we have a long way to go, but I think, you know, there's some progress being made. I think more people are being aware of it. And so I even remember when the movie Napoli Ever After came on Netflix with Sanaa Lathan,
yeah.
And a lot of people weren't happy that she was, even though they were happy, like, the movie was being made, she wasn't the typical, people thought, like, a darker skinned woman could have played that part as well to show, you know, with her, with maybe natural 4C hair as opposed to the hair type that Sanaa Lathan holds.
I'd be remiss if I did not shout out the newly crowned Miss Universe 2019.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, she is Miss South Africa. I'm probably going to mess up her name. Zozabini Tunzi. Beautiful black woman of brown skin with, look, natural cropped, low-cut hair.
Yeah,
honey, she came through there and she murked, as they say, every single woman. and for the first time in history, you have Miss Teen USA, Miss USA, Miss America, and Miss Universe are all black women.
All
and I think there's like black girl, black woman magic. And I'm just, but Miss South Africa, now Miss Universe, is beautiful. But even after acknowledging by myself when... You know, of course, I'm watching the parade of contestants at home in the bed, and I'm picking out who's going to make the top. And although I always root for the people who are black and brown, and she's beautiful to me, I'm like, they ain't picking her. They just ain't going to pick her.
Mm.
She dark skin, and she got a low cut of hair. They're going to pick Miss, for example, Miss Iceland, who's also beautiful, a light-skinned black woman, biracial, but who also represented being a woman of color, being black in Iceland, but she defied what Iceland, you know, so, but I'm like, okay, that's what they're going to pick. And then for them to pick Miss South Africa, I was on cloud nine. So, yeah, shout out to you.
That was so amazing. Yeah. So amazing. Her speech reminded me of a speech that Lupita gave. I think at one of Essence's dinners or something.
Yeah,
and she gave a similar kind of speech to that. And so, yeah, I'm really, really happy that she won.
I love it.
You know, also for little girls to see, like, I think my self-confidence would have been much higher growing up if I had, like, you know, role models like Lupita and Miss Universe and Michelle Obama when I was younger, because then I would have been able to, like, see myself and my skin color in those women.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you what, Renee, we have really, really enjoyed talking to you today. Thank you so much for writing your piece. It's been a challenge to us and to our listeners to really be thoughtful about the type of language you use, the type of things that we parent, that we kind of say without thinking, the kind of things that people said to us that perhaps we repeat because they're habit or we think they're compliments. So really be much more thoughtful and intentional about the language you're using and make sure that we're not also reciprocating and reproducing the oppression that others put upon us. So we appreciate you so much, and please take care.
Thank you so much.
Yes, be well. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you.
All right, Doc, let's take a quick break. Tell the people who we be.
You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast. The work we do on Strange Fruit wouldn't be possible without your support. If we've made you laugh
or made you think,
we hope you'll consider chipping in.
Visit donate.strangefruitpod.org.
That's donate.strangefruitpod.org. Thank you. Welcome back. You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
So, Doc, you and I often talk about your job as a professor. I mean, obviously, your job as a professor and my job as a student is what brought us together some fateful almost 13 years ago.
Yes.
My life hasn't been the same since. But I've been able to kind of watch as you have gone through your career, and I hear the buck stories, and I see some of them myself when I sit in your classes about what it's like for you to be a teacher, especially one who teaches in PAS, who comes from, you know, a very black department there at Temple, and you having to be here in the Midwest, or the South, and sometimes having to teach. Well, no, you really don't. But I wonder what your experiences are like when you encounter some knuckleheaded students, you know, very rarely, but, you know, every once in a while, maybe if you're in an intro class, I wonder if you ever have students who have antiquated views, right? Maybe reductive views about women or about people of color or about queer folk. And so I wanted to invite to the show someone else who could probably also relate in some way. And she was a guest just a few weeks ago when we talked about black women in motorsports. Please welcome back to the show writer Jonita Davis. Jonita, welcome back.
Hey, how are you?
Great. So you were with us a few weeks ago talking about black women in motorsports. We love that conversation. Mm-hmm. But this time you're back talking to us about one of your pieces you wrote in November for Zora. And it was called The Midwestern Black Professor, teaching MAGA babies is not all right. MAGA being, of course, Make America Great Again. You talk about your own experiences as a college instructor in the Midwest and how you had some very overt and some very direct situations where some knucklehead white students made your teaching interesting, if not difficult. So I thought that might be cool, you know, to hear you and Doc talk about the ways in which things are similar and or different. You know, us being here in Kentucky, you were there in Indiana, and just hearing about what your experiences are like navigating being black women in academia and what it's like when you're trying to teach black subject matter to white students. So I'll let you start. Tell us what led you to write this piece and what you sought to highlight for readers by sharing some of your experiences.
Well, first of all, I'm an adjunct instructor, and I've been so for like 5 years, but I left Purdue University where I was teaching and where I was trained and got my master's degree last year after a very, very, after the situation I wrote about in the piece. And since then, I've been seeing a lot of higher ed type of articles written by white guys about conservatism on campus. And I can't remember the title of it, but just before I wrote this piece, I had read something from a professor, a white professor, talking about how hard it was being a conservative on a college campus. And I'm like, this is not for real. Because honestly, these guys have no problems. They don't know what problems are, basically, is what I thought. Try being a black woman teaching a white student body, kids who have never had a meaningful relationship with a black person before. Then tell me that you have been discriminated against or you have problems on campus, okay? Yeah. So I thought, you know, well, let me see if I can put this out there. And then it just so happens that Morgan Jenkins was doing this series on the Midwest, and it was like a perfect match.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
I loved it. I loved your piece. You talked about how you were teaching this Composition 1 class
yes.
for a group of students and how students were responsible for writing an essay in this class. And when you were reading through the essay, they were using things like colored people, coloreds, race card. Talk to our listeners about how it felt to be sitting, trying to grade these essays and having all of these words thrown at you.
Well, it wasn't just one class. Let me just say that.
Okay.
I taught two classes a semester, and this was not the first semester that this has happened.
So it was a routine. It was a routine. Thing.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I was moved out to. So this campus is a satellite campus out in Northwest Indiana, and so I was moved out there, and I taught two semesters out there. Two or three. There were some issues with administration that I ended up leaving stepping out of the semester anyway. So it was like more than one class I taught. And at the very beginning, I had to see, you know, them talking about colored people or using the same thing that you said, the race card, and even using like derogatory words for, you know, the gay community and things like that. And I'm just sitting there angry. See, because these words trigger something in us. I mean, when you see words that were used, you know, in a time when when my ancestors were being brutalized, seeing those and papers of students that I was responsible for teaching, it kind of did something. And it was like, and I had to, it raised an anger that I had to manage. And I had to kind of keep telling myself that I'm here to teach these students. And I eventually came to the realization that they didn't realize that they were doing anything wrong.
Yeah. So all this is going on. You're reading these essays. These students are using problematic language, let alone probably having being trash writers in terms of the actual composition of the stuff. And so you go to the director of the first year writing program, who was a tenured professor, but she was a white woman, correct?
Yes.
And so she was a woman, you say, that taught two of your courses in grad school. She taught you how to actually teach writing. And so you thought that because you all had this kind of connection and she was your former professor and someone that you had a relationship with, that she would understand and listen to and advise you. But that was not what happened. What did you learn from the interaction? What happened? How did things go down?
Well, I thought, you know, this is easy. I go to her. She's, you know, she trained me. She knows what to do, right? This woman, it blew me away, and it was almost a surreal experience because I felt like I was saying one thing and she was hearing another, maybe. And that's what I felt at the time, but I know now what was going down. But I was telling her what was happening, and she was telling me that I was the problem, that I was igniting, you know, inciting this problem. I was dredging these words, I was somehow getting these students to say these words in, you know, the readings that I was giving them.
The text you were giving them were too racially charged. You should give them just some good old classic American. Wow.
Well, in the reading list that she suggested, now we were allowed to do our own reading list to kind of, you know, give the students some like mentor text to work on. We were allowed to do our own, but her list, it was white men, all white men, and I'm like, they need women of color. They need, you know, especially women. But they need people of color. They need people from the LGBTQ community. They need to hear stories from all over. And so my reading list is very, very diverse. And so she ended up, the first time I went to her, she told me to kind of, you know, just kind of, maybe you incited this by giving them, you know, these readings, and you maybe you shouldn't do that. And I'm like, look, wait.
Yeah, that's like, that's not how this works. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I was like, "Hold on," and I didn't say a lot because I was trying to process, you know. And I just kind of took it and then went back to the classroom. That conversation, I did try to, you know, get some more clarification from her, and it was the same. She really didn't give me any aid at all. And then I thought, and to me, seeing the words "colored" in an essay, that should have triggered certain sequences in the university that we got to do some stuff, you know, because it was more than one paper on this assignment. It was like three papers over two classes at this first time, and then every semester I taught after that, I kept seeing it. But I thought it would trigger something in the university that, you know, we got to do some anti-racism, you know, workshops, or we got to do something with the freshmen and orientation or something. You know, I thought something would happen.
Yeah, and that wasn't the case.
Anybody.
Yeah, that wasn't the case.
Yeah, it wouldn't go past her, and she just kind of threw it back on me.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, wow. I mean, so you decided, because the advice you sought out wasn't fruitful and wasn't helpful, you decided yourself to create a safe classroom environment in which you engage these actual students in a dialogue about questions they might have had in terms of how to reference people of color, how to reference certain races, so on and so forth. Tell our audience how that went down. How did that conversation go?
Well, it was hard at first because I did find myself getting angry as I was describing why they cannot use, you know, words like colored and the N-word at all. You know, we don't do that. You cannot do that. And so, you know, I had to kind of, let some of the anger through. And I think just them seeing a little bit of that kind of humanized it a little bit. And then I kind of stepped back and, you know, kind of closed the door, and I'm like, okay, wait a minute. I'm going to give you a chance to ask questions, because it was obvious to me. They had no idea they had done anything wrong. Nobody had ever told them that they couldn't use this word.
Yeah.
And so that whole class, the class ended up being just a class where I talked to them about appropriate language that very first time, and about what you can and cannot say, what you can and cannot call people. And I told them it's not about feelings, because somebody did say, well, I heard you couldn't say African-American because black people get offended. And I'm like, did you ask a black person if you can call them African-American? And they're like, no, so such and such for my family did. I'm like, okay. Your uncle, such and such, is not the person to ask what to call a black person or a gay person or anybody. And I told them that it's not about being offended. You could get fired.
Yeah.
You could get sued. You could lose your home.
Yeah.
You can lose everything you own if you use these words in the workplace.
Yeah.
That's bottom line.
Yeah, there were real world implications for the language and such. Well, I love it. So let's fast forward now, because after a while, you kind of went through some internal processes to get some assistance, and eventually you were like, "Look, my mental health can't take all this." So you left there, and now you're at a school that serves a largely marginalized community. Correct?
Yes. There the community is like, I think they said like 27% Latino.
Okay, cool. Yeah,
or Latinx. So yeah.
How has that been for you? So now instead of teaching people like what not to say, you're actually having a chance to help students get the support they need to become better writers. Like, what would you say about your experience now as an adjunct, as opposed to when you were there at Purdue?
I feel like I felt like I was doing something before, because there were students that actually did learn from my classes, but I feel like I'm doing more now because I'm helping students that are first generation, students who didn't know that it wasn't against the law to speak Spanish on the job. I had a whole class period this semester where I talked about the First Amendment protects your right to speak your language at your workplace. And if anybody has anything to say about it, I brought up numbers for the ACLU and a couple other places that they could call. And it was like enlightening, mind blowing. And it shocked me that these people were afraid of getting fired for speaking their home language on the workplace. So it's like a different type of circumstances, but I think I'm being more fruitful, and I'm not, and it's not as stressful. It's not as
that's a bunch of a toll on you. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. I'm not tired.
I'm glad you found a place where you feel when you can still make an impact. And you feel more comfortable, Doc. I mean, this sounds absurd. I mean, you don't have to deal with anything quite this bad, huh?
No. I mean, I have a very unique position, though. I think that a lot of my colleagues, unfortunately, have to deal with this. I mean, when you teach the standardized curriculum at universities, whether that be gen ed courses where you're meeting freshmen and sophomores or undeclared majors, or when you're teaching 400 to 500 levels, but it's a part of the general curriculum in your department, you will get students from other colleges, other departments, and students who aren't necessarily for diversity and inclusion or intersectionality or haven't heard of Black feminism or the fact that, you know, queer folk are woke or anything like that. So my colleagues have my course titles are inflammatory on purpose, in the sense that most who sign up for my course just don't hold those views. Or at least they don't feel comfortable sharing them in my classroom. So Black Lesbian Lives, ain't nobody a magma person going to be trying to go into Black Lesbian Lives, queer performance, Intro to LGBTQ studies. When I would teach gender and public dialogue, which is basically an intro to gender studies course and communication course where they do a lot of public speaking, I would have certain students who I knew were uncomfortable with me as an instructor and also uncomfortable with how much we talked about the intersections of race and sexuality. And I always told them at the beginning of the semester, and when you come to the first day,
this class may not be for you, there's another class.
There's another class for you.
Yeah, I love that you all, that's true. But so you have
And it was also, too, because I was on tenure track, that also put me in a different position. When it comes to contingent faculty and part-time faculty, they are not protected in the same ways. And this is why the university...
Should they be? Do you think this is unfair?
Oh, definitely. It's completely unfair. I mean, the things that universities ask of part-time, contingent, or adjunct faculty without giving them the type of
protection they need financially,
in terms of their contractual agreements, also in terms of benefits packages, also in terms of office space. I mean, they're expected to essentially do the same thing that tenure track professors are doing without secure office space. Without secure office space, with being able to not have job stability. So you're wondering year to year or sometimes semester to semester whether you're going to teach this course or that course. So it's really, really exploitative.
You know, I think much more reliant upon student evaluations. You were a tenure professor, so it's like, oh, she hates Black people, hates white people. Like, that's not going to cut against you.
But no, not at all.
For adjunct, those things matter.
Yes, they very much... They very much matter about rehiring that next semester or rehiring that next year. And that's really the only basis a lot of departments use to rehire contingent faculty. So they're in a very extremely vulnerable position.
Yeah.
And so that's why I really identify with this piece. Right now at U of L, for instance, we're trying to get it to where we have our contingent and part-time faculty and put them on tenure track. Because most universities, they're working with at least 50 to 60% of the faculty that teach classes at universities are not tenure track.
Now, is that because it saves university, money to do this? Like, in other words, they're getting more labor for less money.
Exactly.
And less benefits.
That's it.
Okay, so it's just a money issue.
More labor, less money.
They expect the same quality teaching, right? they still get the same money from students, but they want to give these adjuncts. Wow.
Yeah. So it's really, and that's why I was like, oh my goodness, I really, really loved your piece because it's so timely and so important and necessary to open up the conversation around how tenure track protects tenure faculty or tenurable faculty.
Because you would have to deal with those students talking about color this and color that. I mean, like, because you're tenured and you're protected, you can tell someone's like, that's not what's up, get out of my class.
Yeah, that's what
But an adjunct runs the risk of, you know,
like when I was teaching, when I taught at Temple, before I get to U of L, I taught at Temple, I taught at Drexel, and Temple was where I got my master's and doctorate from. Oh, no, the things I do in my class now, hell no, I wasn't able to do that when I was teaching at Temple. Hell no. I mean, I was like bending over backwards
to accommodate the students.
Just to be more rehirable. I wanted that money. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? I wanted the money. Because I needed the money. I needed to pay my bills and have an apartment. And so you have to be on your P's and Q's. And she went the exact route that you're supposed to go, right? She tried to get advice. She ended up having to really do the work herself. It's so unfortunate. I mean, it's just so unfortunate that there's so many stipulations involved. Well, so when I got the job at U of L, I was really buck wild.
Like, I'm cool.
I said, y'all can get out this class. This ain't for you, okay? Because I ain't changing it and you ain't changing me. So,
well, Janine, I tell you what, we really appreciate you writing this piece. We're so happy that you're in a much better, happier, safer place now. And of course, you know, we love your writing. We're going to keep following and reading your stuff. And please come back anytime you want to. You have open invitation.
Can I add just real quick?
Yeah.
The college I came from is the president is Mitch Daniels. You know, the guy who called Black Scholars.
We know who Mitch Daniels is. He used to be the governor of Indiana, right?
He used to be,
Yeah, he used to be the governor,
He's president of Purdue University right now, and so that was where all the higher ups, you know, were kind of looking to whenever I was causing all them problems.
I just wanted to click
all the dots right there.
Thank you for connecting because as I mentioned, Indiana is our neighbor, and I remember Mitch Daniel. He's a knucklehead. I mean, so again, like I'm saying, I know Purdue, I know all, you know, so So anyway, you have our sympathy, but you also have our congratulations for getting into a better situation, and we wish you happy holidays and take care.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, so thanks to today's guest, Renee Sherez Wedderbaum, who brought it home about the language you use, about really being mindful of anti-Black language that Black people use. And, of course, Zena Davis are coming back to the show and talking all about her experiences teaching across the river over to Indiana. let's give a shout-out to our cookie baker.
Yes. So, soon-to-be doctor, actually.
Oh, yes.
Soon-to-be Dr. Carmen Mitchell. Thank you so much for these yum-tastic snickerdoodles.
But listen, can I be honest with the audience? I can be honest with the audience because they're my friends. You know, so I try to be like nice and crap. I want to bake you all some cookies and bring them to the studio, but she told me they're going to be snickerdoodle. But I didn't have the heart to tell Carmen, and I guess you'll find out now, Carmen, that I do not like...
Jay doesn't like snickerdoodles because he does not like cinnamon.
What are the three cookies I like?
You like chocolate chips, but they have to be basically burnt and dry.
No, they have to be crispy. Because as I always say, the saying goes, that's how the cookie crumbles, not how the cookie smushes. So again, y'all who like soft, Toll House, wet cookies, the saying is, that's how the cookie crumbles. It won't crumble unless it's dry. Okay, so I like chocolate chip.
And you like peanut butter.
And the third one I like is, starts with an S, sugar cookies. Which I don't eat those very often, but yes.
But that's why I don't know why you wouldn't like snickerdoodles, because it's just the cinnamon as the ingredient.
No, cinnamon. I don't understand why cinnamon was ever invented. Because I'm trying to think if there's ever a dish,
you don't like eggnog, though, either?
Oh, no, I don't like eggnog. No, first of all, it doesn't appeal to me to be drinking egg yolk.
Yeah, because isn't it egg yolk? Isn't it raw eggs?
I feel like it's egg yolk and milk mixed together. Probably, I don't know, with cinnamon in it.
I used to really, really get down with eggnog.
But I'm sure, and I'm listening, I'm sure that somebody, if I'm incorrect, you all will correct me, but I don't think that fake eggnog anymore is made with egg. Like, it's a fake-me-out eggnog. You buy the real stuff that has real egg in it, but you know, you can buy like a gallon for $1 at Kroger, it's not going to have real egg in it.
So it's like egg beaters or something like that?
I don't know what it is.
But you used
to like eggnog.
I used to really like
it. At your old apartment, girl, you used to get eggnog. Oh my goodness.
I would drink the whole bottle.
Would you add liquor to it?
Yeah, I would add bourbon.
I'm gonna say you
I would add bourbon or whiskey to it. I love eggs though, but I love eggs. Any kind of eggs.
But you don't do raw eggs. Like, when you go to the gym, do you do like the raw egg situation?
I definitely don't do raw eggs.
Does Missy do that?
No, Missy does not do raw eggs.
People swallow like the swallow raw eggs.
No, no, it's not time.
Okay,
it's not time for that. And now that I'm about to be 40 soon.
You very soon, honey.
Very, very soon.
About a week.
I have basically cut out any kind of yellow egg altogether. It has to be only egg white.
Well, I learned that from you. Can we just go to Denny's? We used to have our weekly breakfast, we go to Denny's, we would always get like the egg whites. And I'm like, I love that scrambled eggs because I don't like wet yolk anyway. Wet yolk. So
let me tell you, we had to go to these candidate interviews and they had us go to dinner at what is that place? Mayan Cafe.
Yes, Mayan Cafe. Yes.
Right there in Nulu, and their food is exquisite. It's so yum. So I decided to order the vegetarian burrito. Okay.
Okay.
So the
was
person
it probably like egg and veggies and mushrooms, stuff like that, or like what's in it?
Well, it just had like I don't know vegetables. What was in it, but it was like all these vegetables and stuff. But then like you know how nowadays they put like fried egg on top of burgers
and all that. Yes.
So I guess they were gonna put egg on top of the burrito as like some kind of garnish or something you would eat.
Yeah, kind of something like with the egg or something. Yeah.
You know. And so I said, oh okay, you know. And I said, so are those? Is it like
did you guys say with scrambled eggs?
No, yeah. So I said so what? I did not say that. I said how is the egg that is going to go on top of this.
Yeah.
And they said, Sunny, sign up.
Okay.
Yes. Yuck. No.
But you can ask for it. Just ask them to fry it hard.
I did.
Okay,
and I explicitly did.
Okay.
But what I'm saying to you now is, as much as I love eggs, I prefer egg whites. I don't do over easy.
You asked them to put a scrambled egg on top of your burrito. You know, I'm just saying.
But I did
simple.
Though. They put a scrambled egg on
okay,
top.
Okay, but the shade is, so you have a sunny side up egg, but next time just tell you fry it hard, so it's still the one circle, but it's just not nothing's ready.
No, no, thank you.
You want a scramble.
I want a scrambled egg. It has to be scrambled or a hard-boiled egg.
Okay.
Like, because I'll put hard-boiled eggs in salads, tuna, tuna fish, stuff like that.
Yes.
No over easy, no sunny side up.
No, nothing.
No eggs Benedict, burnt, because I also don't eat ham. Yuck.
Yeah, I know you don't eat ham.
And then...
But people say that people who like eggs, when you get dishes and they crack the yolk and the yolk pours over their burger or their little...
People say it's like the bomb. People say it's the bomb, but when I used to eat red meat...
I don't even know what the flavor... What is the flavor of even raw egg yolk?
I just don't know. But I know that when people eat... When I used to eat red meat, I remember Missy, my wife, would get her steaks when she used to eat red meat. Get them like I feel like medium rare,
okay.
So it's still like juicing blood,
yeah.
And like that's the way you're supposed to do it, I guess. And that's the way. And like chefs prefer it to be because what chefs do not like you to order no steak well done.
But they don't dislike it. They're offended. In some places they won't cook it that way.
Yeah.
You know, but I tell you what.
But I couldn't do it.
I used to be a well-done person. When I was say working in restaurants, I now would do a slight medium well.
Oh,
I can do a medium well. Because it's still not, it's
so
not
it
bloody.
Just, it's just a little pink.
It's just, I wouldn't say pink. It's like a little bit, I don't know.
Like light like, brown.
Yeah, light brown, like light-skinned. Like light-skinned brain, I don't know. But anyway.
Yuck, no. I mean, our food specifications are so funny, but we really deeply appreciate these cookies, Carmen.
Yeah, all to say, thank you, Carmen, for the cookies.
Yes.
But what I was getting at was, I didn't have the heart to tell her initially, but I'm going to tell her now live on the radio. can we get some chocolate chip dough? You know,
I love that you're peculiar.
Because it was in here snacking, Coach and Angel was snacking.
Yes.
Even Rachel, our receptionist, walked past and took a single little cookie. I'm the only one whose mouth was watering, and I'm over here drinking a Snapple because I can't have a cookie. so if y'all love us, truly,
and you know, Carmen, too, what's so funny about Jay is that he rarely likes any kind of dessert.
I don't like sweets.
So his preference for dessert would be chocolate chip cookies. So,
yes.
He won't even eat pies. And I asked him one time, I said, remember when we first met, I said, how do you not like pie? And you were like, do I like hot fruit?
I don't like hot fruit. Yeah, that's what it is. It's hot fruit with a flour, with some kind of flour. I mean, it's like, you mean like, let's get some so-and-so. We don't want to say neighborhood. You want to get so-and-so apple pie, so-and-so peach cobbler. I'm like.
No, first of all, I don't eat cobbler. I don't eat peach cobbler
but
at all.
But what's the difference between cobbler and pie?
I'll get blueberry cobbler because it has a firm texture. Peach cobbler is wet. And slippery. I'm just
so,
not
but
into
I, but
it.
I do wish that I ate cobblers and pies because in my mind, which I've never had it, pie crust is so buttery and like
so
crunchy.
Flaky and good.
But so if there was some kind of like savory, well, I guess the savory equivalent would be a quiche. With a crusty.
Do you like quiche?
I like quiche. Yeah, I do like quiche.
We're going to
get a savory. It's not hot fruit. It is a savory, salty, you know, taste. Anyway, we digress. Dear listeners, happy holidays. We're going to probably take 2 weeks off. during the holidays. We're not sure yet when, but we'll take 2 weeks off probably during the holidays. Probably in January.
Yeah, no.
We're not going to do it immediately. Yeah. I'm saying like in the holiday season, which technically lasts until like King Day.
Yes.
We'll take 2 weeks off and recuperate. But anyway, we'll be back here next week. So until that time, Doc, say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody. Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media. Our engineer is Koja Tashiro, who also composed our theme music. For more information about Strange Fruit, visit strangefruitpod.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod.
The views expressed on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters. Strange Fruit is produced by me, Kyla Story.
And me, Jason Gardner.
Thanks for listening.